Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of the book of Exodus. We are in Exodus chapter 5, just barely down to verse 7. Moses is now in Egypt. He and Aaron have at last gotten an audience with Pharaoh, and the contest is on. And afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness." This was just a test of Pharaoh. This was not the ultimate objective. They asked him for a small thing, which would prove his unwillingness to do the great thing, to let the people go at the command of the Lord. Pharaoh said, insultingly we might add, blasphemously, "Who is the Lord? Who is this Yahweh that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh. And besides, in any case, I would not let Israel go," as I paraphrase. They come back respectfully, but insistently. "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please, let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may hold a religious festival and sacrifice to the Lord our God. Otherwise, he may fall upon us with pestilence or with sword in refusing to honor him appropriately. That would not be good for us. That would not be good for you." But the king of Egypt was adamant. And he said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Go back to your labors. Worship is not a duty." He views it as harmful, at least in their case, when it came to Yahweh. Again, Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have all these people, my whole labor force, cease from their labors. You have any idea how much that's going to cost me in time and money?" So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters, his own Egyptian taskmasters, who were over the people, and their foreman, the Hebrew foreman, saying, "You are to no longer give the people straw to make brick as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks which they were making previously, you shall still continue to impose upon them. You are not to reduce any of it, because they're lazy. That's why they're crying out, 'Let's go and sacrifice to our God.' Let the labor be heavier upon the men, and let them work at it so that they may pay no attention to false words." He didn't believe Moses and Aaron, didn't believe they had met with God. He felt this was all a deception, a hoax. For whatever agenda, he was having none of it. So the taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, "Thus says Pharaoh, I'm not going to give you any more straw. You go and get the straw for yourselves, wherever you can find it. But none of your labor will be reduced." So the people scattered through the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw, and the taskmasters pressed them, saying, "Complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you had the straw provided for you previously." Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmaster had set over them, they were beaten and were asked, "Why haven't you completed your required quota, either today or yesterday, in making the brick as previously?" The foremen of the sons of Israel came, and they cried out to Pharaoh. Somehow they got an audience, and they said, "Why do you deal this way with your servants? Look, there's no straw given to your servants. Yet they keep saying to us, 'Make bricks, make bricks.' Behold, your servants are being beaten. It is the fault of your own people." And Pharaoh said, "You're lazy. You people are very lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. You're idlers. Now go and work, and you're going to be given no more straw, but you must deliver the quota of bricks that we've assigned. The foremen of the sons of Israel saw them, they were in deep dew, because they were told, you must not reduce your daily amount of bricks. So when they came out from Pharaoh's presence, somewhere out in the courtyard or wherever they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them and hoping to get a positive report, but the Hebrew foreman said to Moses and Aaron, may the Lord look upon you and may he judge you, for you've made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Then Moses returned to the Lord and he said, O Lord, why hast thou brought harm to this people? Why didst thou ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he's done nothing but harm to this people, and you've still not delivered your people at all. Well, to make his point and to discourage any further meddling in his royal affairs and to quash religious aspirations of this kind, Pharaoh figures, the best cure is harder work. There's an old saying, expect poison from standing water. And he figured the Hebrews were standing water. They were too idle, too much time on their hands to think up mischief. So he fixed that by issuing a cruel and a most onerous executive order to his Egyptian taskmasters. The slaves were generally engaged in brickmaking for royal construction projects. If you've been to Egypt, you've seen the remnants of those. They had assigned quotas that they had to produce each day, or their supervisors, for failing to get that production, would be beaten and abused. Previously, the straw that was mixed with the mud that made the bricks, that straw had always been furnished. But now comes a royal directive that henceforth the workers would have to scavenge for their own straw, yet their quotas would not be reduced. And this was because the directive concluded the Hebrew labor force had gone soft. It had gotten into lazy habits in the mind of Pharaoh, and this idleness was a breeding ground for this sudden surge in religious zeal to go into the wilderness and to make sacrifices in honor of their God Yahweh. So this impulse needed to be literally worked out of their system. So in verse 9, Pharaoh tells them they're going to have to work harder. They're going to have to drive these people. They're going to have to tire them out so they would no longer be distracted or influenced by purveyors of religious superstition like Moses and Aaron. Because as far as Pharaoh was concerned, this God Yahweh didn't even exist. And if he did, he wasn't a serious threat or anybody who needed to be honored. So in verses 10 and 11, Pharaoh's overseers immediately implemented the royal order to the letter, and they knew better than not to. In verses 12 through 14, you have the people scurrying about hither and thither throughout the land. They're gathering whatever stubble they could to make the straw necessary to make the bricks. However, that extra labor requirement was making it almost impossible for them to find the additional time and energy, even under the whips of their taskmasters. They just couldn't meet their quotas, and their ire was being taken out on the foremen of the Hebrew work parties. When asked why they weren't meeting their production quotas, the Hebrew foreman said it shouldn't be rocket science to figure out why the shortfall. You're asking us to accomplish the same amount of work in half the time. What's gotten into you people anyway? Why are you doing this to us? It's impossible. Well, somehow, through a process not described, the taskmaster spout the party line. It appears that representatives of them must have appeared before Pharaoh, and what they get is, you people are lazy. It's obvious when you start babbling about taking a religious retreat into the wilderness to sacrifice to this God Yahweh. So we're fixing the problem. So here's the deal from now on. Pharaoh wouldn't give an inch. Straw will no longer be furnished by the government. The labor force will rummage around the countryside. You'll gather it for yourselves, and your production schedule will not be reduced. That is final. Get to work. Well, in verse 19, the foreman, the Hebrew foreman, they saw they were in a really impossible situation. You know, the classic between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they were obliged to honor God in the ways handed down to them from their fathers. Over these 400 years, especially when it turned into a slavery situation, their worship had largely lapsed. During those long years of their oppression, they had fallen into some Egyptian paganism, and they had neglected their honoring of their God. Now their religious sensibilities are awakened through Moses and Aaron, and through them a spark of their ancient faith has been revived in their hearts. God had visited them, thankfully, and now they saw hope. They saw light at the end of the tunnel. But at the moment, all of that is obscured. It's just a matter of daily survival. A lot of people find themselves in that situation. I remember my oldest daughter years ago used to work with teenagers in the Oregon prison system and used to comment how the mentality of those youngsters was just to survive. It was hard to talk to them about looking to the future and long-range planning. Their lives, in many cases, had been so miserable, so oppressive, so abusive, that they only had in view getting through the day, whatever it took. That's kind of where the Hebrews were at this moment. They just had to survive. If they pressed the religious issue, Pharaoh and his Egyptian taskmasters would make things impossible for them. On the other hand, if they abandoned their duty to the God of their fathers, they faced his displeasure. So in verse 20, this situation occasions this royal summit meeting with the leaders of the Israelite labor force. And at the conclusion, they come out where Moses and Aaron were awaiting the outcome of their conference with Pharaoh. We assume they were waiting somewhere outside the palace. And when they emerge from that meeting with Pharaoh, these Hebrew foremen were seriously torqued at Moses and Aaron, to say the least. They accuse Moses and Aaron of being the source of their problems. Because of you and your ideas, you have created a stink and you've made us odious in the sight of Pharaoh and his administrators. Now things are at the point that you've handed these people an excuse to slaughter us in retribution. Thanks. Well, I'd have you note in verse 22 that that response not only exposed the shallowness of Israel's resurgent faith in the Lord that we saw at the end of chapter 4, it just dried up all of a sudden. Like the morning dew on the ground at sunrise, it goes away at the first ray of heat. They feared the wrath of Pharaoh, the wrath of man, more than the wrath of God. And caught betwixt the two, the indignation of a holy God and the indignation of an unholy Pharaoh, an unholy human being, well, they showed they had no confidence in the Lord's power to deliver them. That's where a lot of people are. One could ask, why did the Lord not wash his hands of them right then and there? Well, there we see that the holy God of the Old Testament, we see he is gracious and merciful, and he's slow to anger. He's full of loving kindness and truth, forgiving iniquity, sin, and transgression. Right there it is. We see that he is faithful. Ever faithful. They had not been faithful. But God is faithful to his promises, and he had promised Abraham way back in Genesis. He had promised Abraham to make of his descendants a great nation. He had foretold to Abraham that they would go into a strange country, and there they would be oppressed for 400 years. But eventually, they would be God's conduits to bless the whole earth. Yes, individual Israelites, many of them might falter, and they might fail, and in the end they would refuse to believe or walk with God. Still, their individual failures would not prevent God from fulfilling His national promises to their faithful fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Some of the branches on the vine may be unfruitful, and they would be pruned away. Nevertheless, the vine, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, was holy, and God would preserve that vine, and He would do what He said He would do, as He always does. So the Lord knew how to rid the tree of dead branches, but preserve the tree itself, and He still does. Moses, at this point, was just flattened. He and Aaron were disheartened by this turn of events. The Lord had given Moses a lot of forewarning that this was not going to be a dash, but a marathon. But so often the things the Lord tells us don't really get through to us. We see the same thing in Jesus' disciples. The Lord warned him again and again that he was going to be rejected by men, that he was going to be crucified, that he would go away, but it just didn't land. And that's the way with us. We have the scriptures and we read them. We read Moses and the prophets, and we read the Gospels, and we read the epistles. And some things are clear as crystal, and other things that ought to be somehow are not. And we go through a seriatim of experiences, and then one day it lands. And we see that God was operating outside our little box. Well, here the Lord is operating outside Moses' box. Moses' expectations, Aaron's expectations, they're not met on this occasion. The Lord had been faithful, but they just didn't have the right paradigm in mind. And that's the way it is, folks, with us lots of times. The Lord will always be faithful, but in His ways He will sometimes fool us. So Moses was here very disheartened by this turn of events. Here the Lord had sent him to deliver Israel from the hand of Pharaoh and to free them from the land of Egypt. And now all of a sudden the Lord seems to be not paying for what He ordered. That's kind of the whole theme of my book, Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. If you don't have that book, you ought to get it, because it addresses situations just like this. Matters had gotten worse instead of better. What do you do when you ask God to fill your cup and He eats your lunch? That's what my book is all about. Well, it's deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra said. He was rejected the first time, Moses, I mean, and now the sons of Israel, here they are again, turning on Moses the second time. And Moses just feels lost. Instead of doing Israel good as he came back from the wilderness to do, that's what he expected to do. That was the dream, that was the vision. His coming had only, it seemed, inflicted on them greater harm. So Moses wonders out loud why the Lord ever sent him. The Lord had not delivered them. The Lord's only created circumstances where Pharaoh is hammering them worse than ever before. This is blowing his mind. I've been there. Perhaps you have too. Moses expected God's deliverance through him to consist of a shock and awe demonstration that would bring the king of Egypt to his knees almost immediately, even though God had told him otherwise, and would agree to the release of Israel. Some would have said, I didn't make a note of it. When our hopes are blasted, our plans miscarry, our efforts do more harm than good, or appear to, while we are discredited and blamed, while we are pursued with taunts and the hate of those for whom we were willing to lay down our lives, yes, we may preserve an outward calm, but there may be a heartbreak underneath, and the noblest part in us will wither as corn blasted by an east wind, unless we are able to pour out our whole complaint before God, and Moses was. The agony of soul, the quote continues, through which Moses passed, must have been as death to him. He died right there. Right there he died to his self-esteem. He died to his castle building, to pride in the miracles God had given him to do. He died to the enthusiasm of his people. He died to everything right there that a popular leader loves. Well, folks, why was it beneficial for Moses and Israel to taste this seeming failure, blasting of their hopes right up front? Well, I'll tell you something. God can afford to bring us through passages like this because of the afterward to which they lead. God knows the afterward, and he will sustain us until we get there. Secondly, it was necessary for Moses, Aaron, and all the Hebrews to understand right up front that no power or reasonings or remonstrances or appeals or agitation of any kind would avail to deliver them, so that in the end, their trust was directed to God alone and the glory went to him alone. There is no other help for us when passing through such stern discipline, and the man who has not learned to flee thither in similar straits is pitiable indeed, someone has said. Thirdly, it is said that God must bring us down before he can raise us up. Emptying must precede filling. We must get to the end of ourselves before he can produce his ends in us. F. B. Meyer, whom I've quoted quite a lot because he's got so many good insights into the life of Moses, said, "And out of the whole story there comes to us this lesson. We must never suppose that the difficulties which confront us indicate that we are not on God's path and doing his work. We must not fall into that trap. Indeed, the contrary is generally the case. If we are willing to walk with God, Meyer says, he will test the sincerity and temper of our soul. He will cause men to ride right over our heads. He will bring us through the fire and through the water. But out of all, God will bring us into a large room and give us the very thing which we have been taught to set our hearts on. The further banks of the Red Sea with their song of victory will at last wipe out the memory of those bitter disappointments, those sharp speeches, those hours of lonely anguish." Yes, yes, and yes. Fourthly, the failure of Moses' appeal had the effect of sharpening and clarifying the issue. It was no longer a contest between Moses and Pharaoh. It needs to transcend that, and God so worked that it was all clarified. At last, it was between the God of the Hebrews and the gods of Egypt, and most especially that God, that self-imagined God, Pharaoh. It was not Moses whom Pharaoh was refusing to obey. It was God. That postured things just right. Fifthly, all of this had to transpire this way in the providence of God if Moses was going to be leading these people for the next 40 years. Why? Well, he may as well start learning right now, as any shepherd needs to learn somewhere along the line. He needed to learn right now about their fickle, rebellious, and ungrateful spirit that he was going to have to contend with. False expectations are the death of any leader. He must learn not to become unglued every time they did. I have a wonderful church. I'm so proud of it. But I'll tell you one thing. I've been through some deep valleys, some hard passages. And I've seen all of that. And any pastor sooner or later needs to, so that he has no illusions. In the sixth place, by increasing the bitterness of their lot, the Lord made them more and more restless and dissatisfied with their lot in Egypt. You'll recall later that they started, in spite of their bondage, looking back to Egypt fondly. Sometimes it's hard to get people to break their ties. They've been there so long. Bonded by their shared suffering and finding no expectation of relief from Pharaoh, they were not only glad to get out of Egypt, but at last they were driven to look to God for help. That's always a good thing. Well, dear friends, thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.